Hi, this is Bridget with the Washington Examiner, March 25th, 2026. Empathy Derangement Syndrome. How Democrats' Warped Compassion is Shielding Iran's Killers, by Daniel Ross Goodman. In the first book of Samuel, the prophet delivers a clear command from God to King Saul. Utterly destroy the Amalekites, a vicious enemy of Israel, and leave nothing alive. Not man, woman, child, or beast. Saul obeys in part, routing their army, but when he captures King Agag, he spares the tyrant's life out of misplaced mercy. The prophet Samuel confronts the king in fury, then executes Agag himself. Rabbinic tradition records the devastating aftermath. Agag's lineage survives, eventually producing Haman, the Persian vizier who plots the first attempted genocide of the Jewish people in the book of Esther. From this episode, the sages distilled a timeless warning. He who is merciful when he must be cruel will be cruel when he must be merciful. That ancient diagnosis of misplaced compassion now echoes with terrifying precision in the Democratic Party's swift condemnations of President Donald Trump's decisive military campaign against the Iranian regime. Just weeks after Iran's rulers massacred thousands of their own citizens in the January 2026 uprising, estimates range from 3,000 confirmed deaths to as many as 36,000, the United States and Israel launched Operation Epic Fury. The strikes targeted nuclear sites, military infrastructure, and the regime's command structure, culminating in the death of Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei. Trump made clear the goal: end the threat once and for all and let the Iranian people reclaim their nation. Radical Democrats responded not with relief for the Iranian people or gratitude for the removal of a regime that has sponsored terrorism, hostage-taking, and regional slaughter for nearly five decades, but with immediate condemnation. New York City Mayor Zohran Mamdani called the operation a catastrophic escalation in an illegal war of aggression, decrying bombing cities and killing civilians, while insisting Americans do not want another war in pursuit of regime change. Representative Ilhan Omar, Democrat, Minnesota, labeled it an illegal regime change war, claiming Trump was unilaterally dragging this nation into an illegal and unjustified war. How could leading Democrats rush to shield the world's most repressive regime, one that had just slaughtered its own citizens by the thousands, against decisive American action? The answer lies not merely in Trump derangement syndrome, though that pathology remains potent. It is something deeper, more insidious, and more dangerous, something that I call empathy derangement syndrome. Derived from evolutionary psychologist Gad Saad's concept of suicidal empathy, EDS describes the pathological warping of a healthy human impulse, compassion, into a self-destructive refusal to confront evil when it must be confronted. Empathy becomes deranged when it extends to the cruel at the direct expense of the innocent, the citizen, and the nation itself. A regime that devoured its own. The facts are not in dispute. In January 2026, nationwide protests erupted across Iran after years of economic collapse, brutal theocratic rule, and simmering rage. The regime responded with unprecedented savagery. Security forces, backed by imported foreign militias, opened fire on crowds in Tehran, provincial cities, and beyond. Amnesty International documented massacres on January 8th and 9th alone that pushed the death toll into the thousands. Iran's own supreme leader later admitted that thousands were indeed killed. Independent tallies from human rights activists, news agency, and others put confirmed deaths above 6,000, with credible estimates reaching 36,000. Tens of thousands more were arrested, and many were tortured in hidden facilities. If you've seen Jafar Panahi's It Was Just an Accident, which was nominated for Best International Film at this year's Oscars, you have an inkling as to just how horrific and life-altering these facilities can be. The regime's brutal crackdown was no aberration. Since seizing power in 1979, the Islamic Republic has executed political opponents by the thousands, funded Hezbollah and Hamas to sow regional chaos, taken American hostages, and pursued nuclear weapons in defiance of the world. It is the most murderous regime of the past half century, a sponsor of global terrorism that has American blood on its hands from Beirut to Baghdad to the streets of Israel. Yet when Trump and Israel moved to dismantle its capacity for further slaughter, prominent Democrats could muster no outrage for the victims, only reflexive defense of the butchers. The condemnation was swift and uniform on the left. Mamdani, the socialist mayor of America's largest city, issued his statement within hours of the strikes, framing American and Israeli action, not the regime's mass murder, as the true aggression. Omar, who has long positioned herself as a voice for the oppressed, invoked her own refugee background to argue that military force solves nothing, ignoring that the force here targeted the very oppressors who export horror. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, Democrat, New York, focused not on the regime's nuclear ambitions or its fresh atrocities, but on the supposed domestic cost of confronting them and the lack of congressional authorization. These were not cautious calls for congressional oversight. They were immediate moral inversions. The regime's victims became afterthoughts, while the regime's enablers became the aggrieved. The pattern extended across the party. House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries, Democrat, New York, denounced the strikes as lacking proper authorization, warning that troops were being put in harm's way without justification, while acknowledging Iran has a bad actor that must be confronted. But not this way, not now. Former Vice President Kamala Harris declared her opposition to a regime change war in Iran, insisting that Trump's actions placed American lives at unnecessary risk for a war of choice. Governor Gavin Newsom, Democrat, California, called the operation an illegal, dangerous war that risked American service members, even as he condemned the regime's repressiveness in separate remarks. Representative Rashida Tlaib, Democrat, Michigan, framed the strikes as fulfilling violent fantasies of political elites and the Israeli apartheid government, insisting voters wanted no more wars. These voices coalesced almost instantly, prioritizing procedural objections, fears of escalation, and an anti-interventionist rhetoric over any celebration of the regime's weakening or the Iranian people's potential liberation. Amid this chorus, one prominent Democrat stood apart. Senator John Fetterman, Democrat, Pennsylvania, praised the strikes as entirely appropriate and necessary, declaring on social media that he was baffled why so many in his party refused to support action to prevent Iran from acquiring nuclear weapons. He celebrated the elimination of 49 leaders of one of the most evil regimes in recorded history, questioned who would grieve for such figures, and affirmed that Trump had done what's right and necessary to produce real peace in the region. Fetterman vowed to vote against any resolution limiting the operation, bucking his party leaders to stand with the military effort and the goal of dismantling a murderous theocracy. His position highlighted the rarity of moral clarity within Democratic ranks, where most rushed to condemn rather than confront evil. This pattern is not isolated. It is the predictable outcome when empathy becomes deranged. Saul's shadow. Saul's failure was not a lack of empathy. It was empathy untethered from justice, proportion, or divine command. He looked upon Agag and saw a fellow king worthy of mercy, rather than the embodiment of generational evil. The sages understood the danger. Compassion misdirected does not remain neutral. It metastasizes. Mercy to the predator becomes cruelty to the prey. The Democratic Party today exhibits this same inversion. Its empathy flows freely toward criminal migrants, Hamas sympathizers, and the Iranian regime's apologists, while hardening against American citizens murdered by illegal entrants, Israeli civilians slaughtered on October 7th, and the Iranian protesters gunned down in the streets. Gad Saad, as I mentioned, has documented this phenomenon as suicidal empathy, the evolutionary mismatch where modern humans extend tribal altruism to outgroups that actively seek their destruction. In evolutionary terms, empathy evolved to strengthen in-group survival. When weaponized against the in-group, through open borders that empower cartels, sanctuary policies that shield killers, or foreign policies that appease theocrats, it becomes suicidal. Democrats have institutionalized this derangement. They cannot bring themselves to prioritize American lives over those who would harm them. The State of the Union test that Democrats failed. The syndrome was on grotesque display during Trump's February 24th State of the Union address. Trump invited every member of Congress to stand if they agreed with a simple proposition. The first duty of the American government is to protect American citizens, not illegal aliens. Republicans rose as one. Democrats remained seated. Many refused even to applaud when the president highlighted families whose loved ones had been murdered by illegal immigrants. Families the president invited as guests of honor. When Trump pressed the point, some Democrats shouted interruptions. Omar reportedly interjected accusations against the administration during remarks on protecting citizens. The chamber offered a live-action demonstration of EDS. Empathy for the perpetrator class, illegal entrants who commit crimes, regimes that export terror, had crowded out basic solidarity with American victims and the fundamental duty of government. "You should be ashamed of yourselves," Trump rightfully castigated them. Their refusal to stand was not mere partisanship. It was the public manifestation of deranged empathy, compassion so warped that it cannot affirm the self-preservation of the nation it was elected to serve. Empathy derangement syndrome operates through several mechanisms. First, selective outrage. The deaths of Iranian protesters receive minimal attention. Second, moral equivalence. Trump's targeted operation to neutralize a nuclear threat and end a massacre machine is equated with aggression or regime change war, as if removing Khomeini's death cult were morally identical to the cult's own crimes. Third, domestic inversion. Foreign tyrants and domestic criminals become the objects of protective instinct, while law-abiding citizens and victims are treated as abstractions. This is not compassion. It is a psychological disorder dressed in the language of virtue. It leads directly to policy failures, such as open borders, that have flooded communities with fentanyl and violence, reluctance to confront Islamist terrorism, and hesitation before existential threats like a nuclear Iran. Saad's framework explains why. Once empathy detaches from rational boundaries and in-group loyalty, it becomes a suicide pact. The party that once understood evil, whether Soviet communism or radical Islam in earlier eras, now flinches from naming it when doing so requires force. The ancient rabbis saw this clearly in Saul. Modern observers see it in the reflexive democratic instinct to criticize Trump's success against Iran while the blood of the regime's victims is still fresh. The pattern repeats. Empathy for the Amalekite king, empathy for the mullahs, and empathy for the criminal at the expense of the citizen. What deranged empathy costs America? The consequences extend far beyond one military operation. EDS erodes the moral clarity required for national survival. First, it weakens deterrence. Adversaries from Tehran to Beijing to the cartels on our southern border sense weakness and exploit it. Second, it fractures the social contract. When government officials prioritize outsiders over citizens, trust collapses. Third, it distorts elections and discourse. Voters who watch Democrats sit during a call to protect Americans recognize the betrayal. Trump's action in Iran demonstrates the antidote, moral courage rooted in clear-eyed realism. By moving decisively with Israel against a regime that had just proven its willingness to slaughter its own people en masse, he reaffirmed that America will not indulge evil out of misplaced compassion. The operation has already degraded Iran's nuclear program, crippled its military projection, and signaled to the Iranian people that the world will not forever tolerate their oppressors. Democrats' response reveals a party captured by ideology over instinct, by performative empathy over genuine justice. Their instant alignment against the strike exposes their EDS in real time. This is not principled anti-war sentiment. It is derangement, the inability to distinguish between aggressor and defender, between tyrant and liberator. History will record the January 2026 massacres as among the worst state-sponsored slaughters of the modern era. It will record Trump's February strikes as the necessary response that a deranged opposition tried to thwart. The sage's warning to Saul rings across millennia. Mercy to the cruel invites cruelty in turn. Democrats, in their empathy derangement, risk proving the lesson once again, at the expense of American security, Iranian freedom, and the basic duty to protect one's own. The regime that destroyed tens of thousands of its citizens now faces the consequences of its evil. The party that rushed to its defense faces a reckoning of its own. America, under decisive leadership, has chosen strength over suicidal sentimentality. The contrast could not be clearer. Red Fred's Educational Adventure. Chinese Influence in U.S. Private Schools Attracts Scrutiny, by Taylor Millard. Despite the U.S. government taking a stronger stance toward China, one of the largest owners of American private schools is controlled by a firm chaired by Fred Hu, a self-described Chinese nationalist popularly known as Red Fred. The Spring Educational Group operates 240 schools across 19 states, owning everything from a series of Montessori schools in Southern California to a network of private schools in New York, Washington, and Virginia. Little was said about the investment until 2019, when more than 190 New York City families asked school leaders if the new ownership meant higher tuition. More scrutiny followed in 2023 after Governor Ron DeSantis, Republican, Florida, removed spring education from the state's scholarship funds, saying it had direct ties to the Chinese Communist Party. Spring Education is owned by Primavera Capital, a Hong Kong-based investment firm with a massive financial footprint. This includes stakes in e-commerce giant Alibaba, TikTok owner ByteDance, Palantir, and Yum China, the operator of KFC and Pizza Hut in China. Hu is a public business figure on both sides of the Pacific, having held positions within the International Monetary Fund and World Economic Forum. While his professional resume is highly visible, Hu has largely kept his political views and affiliations private. Even as his financial ascent has unfolded alongside China's economic rise. Born in 1963 in Taolin Temple Town in Hunan Province, Hu came of age during Mao Zedong's Cultural Revolution, when the CCP sought to purge capitalism from China. In an interview with Changsha Daily, Hu said the idealistic elements in the revolutionary tradition influenced him. A self-described nationalist with an emphasis on Chinese identity, he pursued a master's degree in engineering science from Tsinghua University and a master's and doctorate in economics from Harvard University. I believe that my skills, knowledge, and experience are very much needed in China, and I am able to serve the country, Hu said. After completing his studies, he joined the IMF to advise the Chinese government on macroeconomic policy and provide technical assistance, including tax and fiscal reforms, and later became a chief economist at the WEF. During that period, Hu said his optimism about China's economic future caused people to believe he was too biased toward Beijing. "They called me Red Fred," he told the outlet. Hu continues to hold a red Chinese passport and has said it was impossible for him to accept allegiance to another country, a stance that followed him into the private sector. Hu later worked at Goldman Sachs China, where he helped state-owned enterprises access international capital markets, including the Aluminum Corporation of China, China National Petroleum Corporation, and multiple Chinese banks. He played a key role in restructuring the Industrial and Commercial Bank of China, convincing Goldman Sachs executives to take a direct investment stake rather than serve as advisors. Hu is a very accomplished businessman and economist who has served on many boards and positions advising major financial institutions and government bodies in both the U.S. and China. Jennifer Richmond of the Foundation for Defense of Democracies said in an interview. As part of China's financial sector, Hu came into contact with Jack Ma, the founder of Alibaba. That relationship, combined with Hu's government and institutional ties, laid the groundwork for Primavera Capital, which Hu co-founded in 2010. Hu emerged as a major financial backer of Ma's companies, serving as a pre-initial public offering anchor investor in Alibaba. Through Primavera, he invested in several Alibaba subsidiaries and took a seat on Ant Group's board of directors. Hu and Ma also invested $460 million in Yum China, with Hu joining the company's board. When Ma withdrew from public view after Chinese regulators launched an antitrust investigation, Hu struck a careful balance in public remarks. He said Ma was safe and sound, and called China's investigation nothing out of the ordinary. This careful balancing act extends to Hu's political involvement. He denies being a CCP member, and Primavera officials have defended his reputation when questioned by Western media. Yet Hu has appeared at party-adjacent functions, including speaking at a 2016 symposium with members of the 11th Hunan Provincial Committee of the Chinese People's Political Consultative Conference, an advisory body of the Chinese state. Months later, Hu said one reason he returned to Hunan was to serve on the provincial committee. "I am very willing to play a role in Hunan's economic and social development through the CPPCC platform," he said in an interview published on the official website of the Hunan Provincial CPPCC. In 2017, Hu began to draw attention from American politicians as Primavera moved into the U.S. private school sector. Primavera's entry into private education came when it spent $500 million to take over Stratford School, a California-based system for preschool through eighth grade. 8 months later, Primavera, through its Spring Education Group subsidiary, took over Nobel Learning Communities, plus portions of La Porte Schools, rapidly expanding its U.S. footprint. The transactions were presented as targeted investments, citing Primavera's prior experience in education, and they were approved by federal regulators. With increased expansion came more scrutiny. Parents in New York raised concerns after the firm bought Basis Independent School, pushing its U.S. portfolio to 238 schools. Families questioned whether the new ownership would lead to higher tuition. Primavera paused further education acquisitions until 2022, when it purchased Princeton Review and Tutor.com, the latter of which holds a long-standing contract with the Pentagon. Richmond said Hu and Primavera's interest in private education could be seen as a sound financial strategy. However, she said, knowing the educational strategy of the CCP, we must watch his trend carefully. By fall 2023, Spring Education and Primavera had come to DeSantis's attention. Earlier that year, DeSantis signed legislation barring schools affiliated with China from taking part in the scholarship program. Following an investigation, his administration said it would suspend school choice scholarships to four schools connected with Spring Education. We will not put up with any attempt to influence students with a communist ideology or allow Floridians' tax dollars to go to schools that are connected to our foreign adversaries, declared DeSantis. Federal scrutiny followed. Months later, Senator Bill Cassidy, Republican Louisiana, announced an investigation into whether Primavera's purchase of Tutor.com would allow the CCP to access user data. In a letter to Tutor.com executives, Cassidy cited Primavera's investment in ByteDance and warned the firm could pose a potential threat to U.S. interests. He demanded that Tutor.com explain how it collected and protected data, as well as its relationship with Primavera. Primavera quietly sold Tutor.com and Princeton Review last fall to an unnamed American company. Hu and Primavera's involvement in American education has prompted analysts to question how the U.S. balances its commitment to free markets with growing national security concerns. For Richmond, Primavera shows a broader shift where national security outweighs economic openness. Education, even private education, is a community good, Richmond said. While it should promote the marketplace of ideas, it should not conform to market principles where malign influences have more than stakeholder returns as their primary objective. As it stands, whose investments underscore the tensions between economic openness and national security? A legal transition. Successful detransitioner lawsuit could be turning point on gender ideology. By Nicole Russell. When our grandchildren study this period of time in school and learn about the rise of transgender ideology that captivated leftists, the legacy media, and many younger people for nearly two decades, January 2026 will be one of several key turning points in the effort to protect minors from poor life-altering decisions about their bodies. For the first time ever, a jury found New York doctors liable for medical malpractice on January 30th. Fox Varian 2022 won a $2 million decision in a landmark lawsuit against a surgeon and psychologist for facilitating her double mastectomy when she was just 16. The young detransitioner was awarded $1.6 million for past and future pain and suffering, and an additional $400,000 for future medical expenses. This is the first detransitioner malpractice lawsuit in the nation to go to trial and result in a win. The significance cannot be overstated. Varian's lawsuit claimed that her providers failed to obtain adequate informed consent regarding the risks of a double mastectomy. The case highlights just how vague medical practitioners have been about the risks associated with gender-affirming care, something the whole of the medical community only recently embraced as not just advanced, but necessary, even life-saving. Ripple effect. The real-world effects of Varian's win were swift, especially in the medical community. Within days, two major medical associations walked back their previous positions on providing gender-affirming care for minors. The American Society of Plastic Surgeons became the first major medical association to recommend against gender-affirming surgeries for minors. ASPS concludes there is insufficient evidence demonstrating a favorable risk-benefit ratio for the pathway of gender-related endocrine and surgical interventions in children and adolescents. ASPS recommends that surgeons delay gender-related breast, genital, and facial surgery until a patient is at least 19 years old. The February 3rd statement reads, "This quick reversal is significant. The nearly 100-year-old organization represents more than 11,000 physicians." In a statement to National Review, the American Medical Association said that because the evidence for gender-affirming surgical intervention in minors is insufficient for us to make a definitive statement, the AMA agrees with ASPS that surgical interventions in minors should be generally deferred to adulthood. It's amazing how quickly medical standards shifted, not because science evolved, but because the possibility of a medical malpractice lawsuit hangs overhead. Medical community dominoes. Hospital systems were next to scale back care, both in response to the Varian lawsuit and the Trump administration's announcement in late 2025 that it would pull Medicare or Medicaid funding from any hospital that provides gender-related treatment for minors. Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. said in a December 18, 2025, statement that the federal government will do everything in its power to stop unsafe, irreversible practices that put our children at risk. On February 18th, New York University Langone Health closed its transgender youth health program. Given the recent departure of our medical director, coupled with the current regulatory environment, we made the difficult decision to discontinue our transgender youth health program, NYU Langone said in a statement. We are committed to helping patients in our care manage this change. This does not impact our pediatric mental health care programs, which will continue. Bay State Health, the largest health care system in Western Massachusetts, announced in a letter to patients on February 9th that it will no longer prescribe puberty blockers or cross-sex hormones to those under 18, citing Trump's funding announcement. This decision offers patients the specialized expertise and continuity of care they need and deserve, and reflects the evolving regulatory landscape that threatens hundreds of millions of dollars in hospital Medicaid and Medicare funding, the health system said. Vanderbilt University Medical Center also discontinued surgeries for transgender adults, citing operational limitations. These reversals are more significant than many conservatives may realize. gender transition surgeries and treatments for minors were popular among liberals, robustly supported by the Biden administration, and the medical community largely marched in lockstep behind these practices. As The Atlantic reported in 2025, doctors often asked parents of gender-confused children if they would rather have a dead son than a live daughter, a double bind that was too terrifying to navigate, despite little evidence on the other side of cross-sex hormones and reassignment surgery that life-altering medical transitions prevented suicidal thoughts and created happy transgender children. In weeks, that shifted among medical professionals, a sea change that will ultimately protect hundreds, or perhaps thousands, of children from making life-altering decisions they will ultimately regret. American doctors are no longer united on the wisdom of medicalizing gender dysphoria in minors. Helen Lewis also wrote in The Atlantic on February 12th. The science doesn't seem so settled after all, and it's important to understand what happened here. Jesse Singel wrote in the New York Times on February 24th. The approach of left-of-center Americans and our institutions to assume that when a scientific organization releases a policy statement on a hot-button issue, that the policy statement must be accurate, is a deeply naive understanding of science, human nature, and politics, and how they intersect. I couldn't agree more. More lawsuits are coming. Variants win against providers who advised and performed gender-affirming care for a minor will undoubtedly result in a surge of similar lawsuits from detransitioners. A 2019 to 2023 study cited in an HHS report found that nearly 14,000 minors received gender-affirming care and over 5,700 had surgeries. On February 11th, the Texas Supreme Court heard the case of a detransitioner from Fort Worth, where I live. According to Soren Aldaco's lawsuit, her counselor recommended Aldaco for a double mastectomy in 2021, after Aldaco had been dabbling in wanting to live as a boy. She underwent the surgery at 19 and suffered complications. Aldaco ultimately detransitioned but didn't file a medical negligence suit until May 2023. What was done to Ms. Aldaco and many people like her is a medical scandal, Aldaco's attorney, John Raymer, told justices. Kids and young adults suffering from severe psychological distress went looking for help, and what they found is medical providers saying that what's going to liberate them from their distress is pumping them full of cross-sex hormones and cutting off their body parts. Providers argue that Aldaco was past the limitations period to hold them accountable for healthcare liability. Unfortunately, much of the suit seems to focus on limitations rather than the core issue: medical malpractice for gender-affirming care. But it is a pertinent example of just how prevalent these suits are about to be throughout the U.S. Attorneys with the Dillon Law Group, LaMondry and Jana, and the Center for American Liberty sent a letter of intent to sue Kaiser Permanente on behalf of perhaps conservatives' most outspoken detransitioner, Chloe Cole, for transgender-related medical care, including puberty blockers, testosterone, and a double mastectomy during her teenage years. Cole has testified repeatedly to lawmakers about the harms of gender-affirming care for children. In February, a Missouri lawmaker introduced the Chloe Cole Act, federal legislation that would block gender-related medical procedures for minors, a welcome step to continue to protect children. Another welcome voice on this issue, perhaps more consequential than any American lawmaker, has been the writer of the famed Harry Potter series, J.K. Rowling. After news of Varian's lawsuit broke, she posted on X a scathing rebuke conservatives should emulate. As more and more detransitioners arrive in court, the public will learn the full extent of the harm done to kids in the name of an ideology, she wrote. Clinicians performing these treatments will go down in history as barbarous activists who betrayed a sacred oath to do no harm. But we should never forget how many people outside the medical profession urged these young people on, gleefully assuring them that anyone advising caution was an evil bigot. I hope by the time our grandchildren are in school, this period of time will be viewed with cynicism and relief that common sense prevailed. So much so that they will question how children who couldn't legally smoke a cigarette or serve in the military were encouraged to change their bodies in a form of care that was eventually dubbed medical malpractice. And one lawsuit helped turn the tide. The filibuster and its discontents. There is a growing appetite in both parties for being able to pass bills with fewer than 60 Senate votes. By W. James Antle III. Raise your hand if you thought the filibuster would be a top issue in the most important Republican Senate primary of this year's midterm elections. Congratulations if that was your guess. The likelihood that many would have made that prediction is small. Nevertheless, that is exactly where Republicans find themselves in the May 26th runoff between Senator John Cornyn, Republican, Texas, and Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton, who has positioned himself as the 74-year-old four-term incumbent's more MAGA-than-thou challenger. The ostensible dividing line was over election integrity, which supporters say the Save America Act will guarantee. It's a sprawling elections bill backed by most Republicans in the Senate, but it is stalled by the chamber's de facto requirement that most legislation needs 60 votes to pass. That is the number of votes required to invoke cloture, end debate, break a filibuster, and allow the bill in question to proceed to a final vote on the floor. Counting independents who caucus with one of the two major parties, Republicans hold 53 seats to the Democrats' 47. A decent majority for these polarized times, but 7 votes short of being able to get this bill across the finish line without a level of Democratic support that is just not going to materialize. Democrats contend that the legislation will disenfranchise many of their voters, because of its strict requirements for proving one's identity and citizenship. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, Democrat, New York, seldom mentions the bill without calling it Jim Crow 2.0, a reference to the racist period when most Southern blacks could not exercise their constitutional right to vote. Various permutations of this bill have been President Donald Trump's top legislative priority this year, to the point where he has threatened not to sign other legislation unless it funds the Department of Homeland Security and ends the partial government shutdown that remained in effect as this story went to press, until Save America has been sent to his desk. Paxton has sought to make the filibuster and the Save America Act the latest example of Cornyn not being a reliable passenger on the Trump train. John Cornyn is a coward who has refused to support abolishing the filibuster to pass this bill, Paxton wrote on social media not long after finishing second in the first round of Republican primary voting. Now, fake news reporters and the establishment are trying to destroy me with misinformation. When Paxton wrote this, there was widespread concern among his supporters that Trump was going to endorse Cornyn to better position the GOP in the general election this November. Trump had indicated he wanted the candidate who did not receive his endorsement to abandon their Senate campaign. The deadline for either candidate to withdraw has since passed. Paxton said in his attack on Cornyn that he would consider dropping out of this race if Senate leadership agrees to lift the filibuster and pass the Save America Act. Cornyn swiftly rejected Paxton's characterization of his views. Contrary to fake news in the Twitterverse, I have supported the Save America Act from day one, he wrote on X. I will happily support the talking filibuster if that's what it takes to pass this into law. He tagged Trump in the post. Cornyn later expounded on his evolving thoughts about the legislative filibuster. Today, Democrats are weaponizing the Senate's rules to block the Save America Act, defund the Department of Homeland Security, and hurt the American people, all to spite President Donald Trump, Cornyn wrote in a March 11th op-ed for the New York Post. But they say openly that if these same rules ever get in Democrats' way, they won't hesitate to rip them up. Cornyn argued that Democrats will eliminate the filibuster once they regain control of the Senate. We can either unilaterally disarm or we can stand and fight, he wrote. We can let the Democrats keep obstructing today and then smash the rules the first chance they get. Or we can act now and use the mandate the American people gave this president and this Congress to secure our elections, protect our homeland, and bring back common sense. The answer is clear. We need to stand, fight, and win, he concluded. Democrats started this fight. Now Republicans should finish it. Conservatives on and adjacent to Capitol Hill have begun pushing to make Democrats spend floor time defending their position through the talking filibuster, which proponents maintain is the filibuster, or at least was until the cloture rules were used to impose a supermajority requirement on legislation. Senator Mike Lee, Republican, Utah, has said any Republican who won't take this approach should perhaps be replaced. Well, I prefer to have our fights with Democrats, and I'm always someone who believes that it's far better for us to have a majority in the United States Senate. Senate Majority Leader John Thune, Republican, South Dakota, told reporters when asked about Lee's comments. But the dispute is ultimately about more than one primary, one Senate rule, or one piece of legislation. There is a broader debate among conservatives and Republicans about how to wield political power once it is granted to them by the voters. Trump has played a role in stoking grassroots resentment of the party's governing class, but it long predates his two non-consecutive terms as president, or even his national political involvement. This sentiment has certainly deepened during Trump's second term because the Republican-controlled Congress has struggled to pass legislation, forcing the administration to rely on executive actions that are easily reversible by future Democratic administrations. Republicans have a tiny majority in the House, but a larger margin for error in the Senate, except for the filibuster. Conservative trifectas don't come often, Heritage Foundation President Kevin Roberts wrote on X, referring to Republicans holding both houses of Congress and the White House. With a $38 trillion debt growing without restraint, Congress cannot squander this historic opportunity to pass a second reconciliation bill. The reconciliation process is not subject to filibusters in the Senate, and therefore allows a limited amount of legislation to be passed along party lines with fewer than 60 votes. The American people handed Republicans a trifecta and a mandate, posted the Republican Study Committee, a group of conservative lawmakers in the House. We have a once-in-a-generation opportunity to deliver real affordability wins for hardworking families and undo the damage Democrats inflicted on this country over the past 4 years. Again, not a call to nuke the filibuster exactly, but a demand for legislative action. For years, conservatives have believed they benefited from the filibuster. There was more they wanted to block than pass, and Democrats were the party of legislative wish lists and big government. Tax cuts could be passed through reconciliation without changing the filibuster rules. That's also how Trump secured funding for immigration enforcement. Throughout history, it has protected Republicans and conservative priorities and principles a lot more often than it has protected Democrats, Thune said of the filibuster in mid-March. His predecessor as Senate Republican leader, longtime Senator Mitch McConnell, Republican Kentucky, was also a staunch defender of the filibuster. During his first term, Trump was a rare Republican supporter of junking the rule. If Democrats in November win the White House and win the House, and if they gain just one seat in the Senate, in January of next year, they will have the votes to end the filibuster. Senator Ted Cruz, Republican Texas, Cornyn's colleague since 2013, warned the Washington Examiner before the 2024 election. They are one vote away from ending the filibuster. When they do that, they will be able to pass whatever legislation they want with 50 votes. Cruz cited amnesty for illegal immigrants, Puerto Rico and D.C. statehood, and Supreme Court packing as the liberal initiatives. A filibuster-less Democratic Senate might pass. Thune made similar comments this month. When Democrats last controlled the Senate, they tried and failed to get rid of the legislative filibuster. They implied it was racist, pointing to segregationists, many of them Democrats, who used the procedural tool to delay or weaken civil rights legislation in the 1950s and 60s. Then-President Joe Biden, a 36-year Senate veteran who often billed himself as a McConnell-style institutionalist, was gradually won over to their position, at least favoring filibuster reforms or carve-outs that would allow Democrats to pass liberal bills on abortion and federalizing elections. Democrats held the narrowest majorities with a 50-50 split, where only Vice President Kamala Harris's tie-breaking vote allowed them to organize the Senate, control the committees, and manage the floor. This marginally improved to a 51-seat majority in 2023, but that was of limited utility because Republicans won the House. Two holdouts kept the filibuster intact, despite a Democratic Senate. Former Senators Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona. Both are now gone from the Senate and consider themselves independents more than Democrats. Manchin was replaced by a Republican, but Sinema's seat is held by a somewhat more progressive Democrat. Now, the bases of both political parties are grappling with the fear that they will never be able to pass much of their agendas because they are unlikely to command a 60-vote majority in the Senate for the foreseeable future. Democrats briefly held one in 2009, but that required two consecutive blue wave elections and a Republican switching parties. Democrats lost their filibuster-proof majority when Republican Scott Brown won the Massachusetts special election to fill the late Senator Ted Kennedy's seat. This, in turn, forced Democrats to alter their strategy for passing Obamacare and abandoned certain progressive provisions that could not be enacted through reconciliation. The Senate map will likely get tougher for Democrats in future elections, but Republicans also fear they won't win enough seats to have the votes to accomplish what they want to. If you're willing to accept the filibuster excuse for Republicans not passing the SAVE Act or any other significant piece of actual conservative legislation, then what you're saying is that you're okay with Republicans in Congress never passing any conservative legislation ever again, wrote the conservative influencer Matt Walsh on X. Republicans aren't getting a filibuster-proof majority. So either we barrel through and advance our agenda by force, filibuster be damned, or it will never happen, Walsh added. Those are your choices. Progressives feel the same way, although Democratic enthusiasm for eliminating the filibuster has cooled since Republicans recaptured the majority. Democrats have twice used the filibuster to shut down the government, blocking funding bills that have majority support. Governor Janet Mills, Democrat, Maine, who is running against a more progressive primary opponent for the right to challenge Senator Susan Collins, Republican, Maine, has cited abortion, one of the policy areas that made liberals want to get rid of the filibuster back when Democrats held a narrow majority, as a reason to keep it. The governor believes the filibuster is the only thing standing between Republicans and a nationwide abortion ban. A Mills spokesman told Slate, "Some left-wing groups have backed off their insistence on filibuster elimination, at least for now." Interesting how rarely you hear Dems and progressives talking about filibuster reform these days, when it used to be a litmus issue. Maine-based political journalist Alex Seitz-Wald quipped, "I wonder if something changed." Nevertheless, the Democrats' past support for eliminating the filibuster for their favorite bills has persuaded some Republicans that they should strike first. This is the argument Cornyn has made. In 2024, Schumer confirmed to reporters that Democrats mean to finish the job and kill the filibuster's 60-vote threshold the next time they take the majority. Cornyn wrote, "For many years, I believed that if the U.S. Senate scrapped the filibuster, Texas and our nation would stand to lose more than we would gain. But when the reality on the ground changes, leaders must take stock and adapt." Not everyone is happy with the change, including those who see it as more of an adaptation to partisanship and primary politics. This includes an erstwhile Democrat who spent considerable time and political capital on the issue. "When Democrats wanted to eliminate the filibuster in 2022, I stood my ground because I understood the consequences of turning the Senate into a glorified house with simple majority rule," Manchin responded on X. Senator John Cornyn of the Democrats at the time, "They'll soon find themselves rueing the day their party broke the Senate." The West Virginian said it was deeply disappointing to see that Senator Cornyn is now willing to scrap the very rule he once praised, and personally thanked me for defending. In fact, Texas Republicans may make their Senate choice based on who will fight the filibuster harder, at least until the party is in the minority again. Okay, that's all the time that we have for today. Thank you.